Coming to you semi-live from the Dr. Roman Armitage Memorial High School AV Room, welcome to episode 122 of the Horror Podcast. My name is Tyler, and I happen to be the editor-in-chief of Signal Horizon, a magazine dedicated to exploring genre fiction in and out of the classroom.
And I am Oren Gray, Monster Ambassador for Signal Horizon.
Yeah, Monster Ambassador. One of these days, I gotta figure out, which particular monster that you are the ambassador for, or if it's just all of them.
Right.
Okay. All right. All right. That's fair. Including the blob?
Sure. It's a monster.
Okay. Fair. Well, tonight on the Horror Podcast, we're going to spend some time talking about what we've been watching, what we've been reading. We're going to try to help you find some free genre content on the internet. And finally, we're going to spend the remainder of the episode getting sticky with the 1988 version of the blob. But before we get to that discussion, Oren, what's going on? What have you been watching? What have you been reading?
As usual, I haven't watched anything new in like a year for some reason. But I did watch, I just watched Messiah of Evil from 1973, which is super good. Oh my God.
Oh, all right.
It is very, 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 very odd and not... It's barely a movie. Like, it's more like a sort of impressionistic blur of movie parts.
Okay.
But it's really good. And it's very like Lovecraft's Crawling Chaos or The Yellow Sign or something, but like by way of a Italian zombie movie. It's super good.
All right. So give me like maybe the basic plot structure.
There's not really one. So there's this town and some people show up in it. The main character is this woman who's looking for her father who lived there. He was an artist and he moved to this town after her mother died. And all the people in the town are acting strangely. And that's about it as far as plot goes. Like,
okay. Sounds good. Now
it's just like atmosphere and weird events from there on.
Okay. I'm down for that. About how long?
I don't know, 89 minutes, something like that.
That's under 90. I like it. And how did you watch it?
I watched it on this like really crackly, poppy, scratchy version on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Which honestly, I think that may have actually added to the experience rather than detracted from it in this case. Like it's very... It's such an odd, idiosyncratic film that watching it on a way that didn't look like it was meant for public consumption kind of made it better, I think.
Okay, that's cool. Like, yeah.
Like the color gradient would change partway through shots and things because it was just a really shitty transfer, but I think it actually helped.
Cool. So. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I was reading, I don't remember what movie I was reading the Blu-ray review of, but it was something that came out recently, maybe from the 1970s, but it got, you know, one of those vanity Blu-ray releases. And like the big criticism was they, in the new release, they removed all the grain, you know, they removed all of the dinginess that made those movies so fun to watch. And like, I do think that there is a certain amount of, I don't know, atmosphere or something that, that, poor transfers or whatever we want to call it can really bring to the viewing experience.
Oh yeah. So like one of my favorite films from the 30s is Dr. X, which I recently picked up on Blu-ray, which I haven't watched it on Blu-ray yet, but Dr. X was one of the first films shot in what they called two-strip Technicolor. So one of the earliest Technicolor processes. And like the result is this really lurid, weird color that nothing looks right. Like nothing looks natural at all. Everything is like greens and yellows and stuff. Nothing is a normal natural color. Ooh. And I'm told that like the Blu-ray version, they've restored it and it's a much more naturalistic palette, which I think will actually be damaging to it. I'm curious to see the differences. But like, I don't think I think I will probably always keep the old version around just because that's kind of the version I think of it as. So, sure.
Yeah. I think it would probably be fun to view both of those and to be like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. This movie's not nearly as weird as I remember it. you know, it looks roughly normal or whatever.
Well, I mean, even when I saw Suspiria, when I saw the new, cleaned up master in the theater, the colors were different. Like they're still really weird. They're still the very bold, weird colors they were for, but like where I was used to it being very pink, it was very red.
Oh,
and that was just very different. Like, you know, because the colors are really an important part of Suspiria, and so to see them different was a very different experience.
Yeah, well, and I have come to associate, whether it be good or bad, I'm not a huge Giallo fan. I've tried. It's not that I hate that stuff. It's just not my go-to, you know, and I think it is for a lot of people, and bravo to those folks. But in my mind, I think of them as like these big pops of neon colors, you know, and if we are replacing the neon with the prime colors, I think that totally changes things, you know?
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe it updates it. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. Well, I'll have to check it out. Keep that in mind. Well, I've been doing a lot as always. So first and foremost, I just got done reading, The Lost Village by Camelia Stern, and it's translated from, I think the, Swedish, maybe, by Alexandra Fleming. And it is so good. Like, it takes what I always kind of thought was a strictly American trope, which is like the idea of ghost towns, right? And places it in a foreign country, with foreign names and with this its own kind of folk horror elements to it. But I absolutely loved it. It uses the artifice of like a documentarian crew that kind of gets caught up in this small town for a variety of reasons. I thought the twist was excellent and I didn't see coming. But it was just so much fun. Like it was the first time in a little while I've been so giddy that I like definitely wanted to talk about something. But it is real, real, real good. I would say I've also, I just got done watching The Initiation, which is a brand new film. Just came out, I think, last week. It does some really innovative stuff with social media. Essentially, it's a story of, it's like a college slasher, essentially.
Okay.
But they do some really innovative stuff with social media where they like you get this big party at the beginning and essentially overlaid on all the frat and sorority people dancing are their Instagram profiles, right? And like every time they post something, it kind of takes them out of the action and shows you what they post. It doesn't like I was really excited that they would use all that shit later, you know, and they did not. Which you know, like it was this great opportunity and they didn't make the most of it, but at least they did it. And I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. And makes that slasher kind of unique. The rest of the movie I would not say is overly different. There's a driller killer in it, which, you know, if you're a fan of the genre, then you know, like, clearly they're paying homage to something bigger, which is fine. But, you know, generally speaking, it was fine. I would say don't pay money to see it, but if it shows up on one of your streaming networks, then, you know, like, it's a good way I think it was 92 minutes, so it was technically 2 minutes over what I wanted it to be, but I gave it the extra 2 minutes, so it was probably worth the extra.
Shut it off 2 minutes before the end.
Yeah, well,
I was like, nope, 90 minutes, I'm done.
I mean, if I'm being honest, that would have been okay. the ending's not wonderful, but it's not terrible too. I don't want to be too harsh on it because it was fine. It was fine. I'm much happier I watched that than like Wonder Woman 1984, you know, like, so hell. And I guarantee you this budget, Yeah, this budget was significantly smaller. So, and then the last thing I want to mention, there is a litany, and I'll drop it here in the show notes. I bought into HBO Max a while ago, just because it had Lovecraft Country and some other things that I was really excited about. And I knew if we were going to cover it, then I wanted to be able to see it and see it pretty quick. And honestly speaking, over the last 3 or 4 months, before I was vaccinated, that was the only way to see like new movies, right? So that's how I saw Godzilla. I saw it. Well, no, I take that back. I saw it the second time at home. First time I saw it in the theater. It was the first one back. But regardless, they have all kinds of really great old movies that are currently old horror movies that are currently just all over, including our Dark Corner of the Web, which I will I'll transition to now. At some point I will cut some sort of bumper to go in between there. But you can watch the older version of The Blob on HBO Max. I would say don't buy HBO Max for it. The 1958 version is obviously what I'm talking about. Because you can also watch that for free on like Crackle and Tubi and a couple of other locations.
I'm sure the Criterion Channel, because Criterion put it out. So
yeah, yeah, just tons. But if you love like all of the King Kong movies are there right now. So you have King Kong, you have Son of Kong, you have, I think, probably half a dozen Godzilla movies, just a ton of really great stuff. So yeah, like if you already have HBO Go, I think you get HBO Max, and take advantage of all these movies that Oren's going to tell you to see, because he has seen them all, and I have woefully not. So it's on my agenda. So
yeah, I still don't have HBO Max. I'm going to get it at some point because I want to watch Malignant on it. But by then I'll be able to see it in theaters. So maybe I'll just, I don't know. We'll see.
There you go.
But by the time Malignant comes out, I'll be able to just go to theaters willy nilly, I hope, because I'll be all vaccinated and it's going to be like September or some shit. So
yeah,
all the way till September again. But
It is what it is. I'm really disappointed because AMC used to run like movies in the early afternoon, right?
Right.
And if I could get out of school right at 2:38, I can make it to a movie and then make it to, you know, pick up for preschool or whatever by four, whenever. And I saw a ton of movies that way. And sometimes, like, that was the only way I would see a movie in a week, is to kind of carve out this time. And now nobody's got movies to start before 5. And it's like,
I mean, except on weekends, which doesn't help you. Yeah.
Exactly. Right? Like, I got family duties then. It's no fun. But anyway. Yeah, so anyways, check out The Blob, the original 1958 version. That is our Dark Corner. I think it's really fun. I would say not quite as fun as the version we're going to talk about tonight, but you can definitely see where one spawned the other, which I always think is a super fun experiment to partake in. So,
and I'm going to talk about the 58 version a lot when we talk about the 88 version. So
that's good. So if you, especially if you like what Oren's saying, then you can check that out and it'll be really easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is, if they can trust you to be the horror genius that you say you are, because it's time to play Horror Trivia Pursuit.
I get to fail at this again. No, I did really good last time, so we'll see.
Hell yeah, you kicked ass last time.
Well, last time I like only missed the question of the movie I had actually seen. I know, I'd seen most of them, but
okay. Are you ready for category number one? The first category is the purple category that we found out last episode is the monster category. And here is your question. In Army of Darkness, 1992, the incantation Ash has trouble reciting properly was a reference to what classic sci-fi film?
The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Ding, ding, ding. I need to get a little bell and just ring it. Okay.
I guess that's a that's a weird stretch to put that in a monster category, but I guess so.
Yeah. I think there is I guess there's not a sci-fi category. I feel like there's
right. I feel like the Gort thing is more a robot, but there's not a robot category either. So I guess robots go in monsters. And
yeah, I guess it's not that big a stretch. Take it up with Trivia Pursuit, Oren. All
right. Right. I need to write them a stiff letter.
Okay. Our purple category is gore and disturbing. How many members does the criminal gang have in the last house on the left, the 1972 version? One of my least favorite movies, by the way.
I've never actually seen it. I've never seen any version, actually. But it so it doesn't sound like my thing that I've avoided, even though it's like really important. So like I know a bunch of stuff about it from osmosis, but I've never seen it.
Yeah.
I wanna say like four, five, four.
Final answer?
Five? Let's go with five.
It was four.
Damn. Oh well. Oh,
you know, so close.
I tried. I was close.
They also listed them, though, so this is interesting. What? Yeah. Their names are Krug Stillo, Junior Stillo, Sadie, and Fred the Weasel Podowski.
Wow.
There is a lot of character development for these fucking people.
Fred?
Jeez. All right. Whatever. Yeah, and again, not like, that's just not my subgenre. And also, Fred. If you're... cisgender hetero male, and that is your subgenre. I think that's a little weird. So, I'm gonna quietly judge you because I won't do it out loud because I'm a wuss. So, all right. Here is a third category, which is the brain category, and that is psychological. What is the color of the lanterns lit at the houses of the invitation members? Of the invitation, members in the invitation, the 2015 movie. That's worded really weird.
That's really weird. Have we done this one before? Red.
Yeah, I thought.
I feel like we've maybe done that one before.
Uh-oh.
Maybe not. I don't know. Yeah. For red, anyway. Yeah. We haven't done the others, so.
Yeah.
I remember the Last House on the Left one, so I don't know. But,
yeah, whatever. They happen to be a big fan of Catherine Kusawa's The Invitation. So
yeah.
I think that's who directed it. That's great.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Okay, Orange, which is paranormal. The final scene in the 1976 version of Carrie is revealed to be the dream of whom?
The girl who isn't dead. I don't remember her name. the girl who survives the prom massacre, but I don't remember her name.
Shame on you. Shame on you. I'm so disappointed. I would have had no clue. It is Sue Snell? Schnell?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. People better than us would have gotten that clue.
Right? Like, one of the things I've noticed about this Trivial Pursuit is they're, like, they're really convinced that I know the names of these fucking people. I do not.
Yeah, dude. Like, I like names. I could probably get a year within two or three. Like plot details, I could probably nail down. I might even know like town names more than I would know character names, dude.
Right. I could probably tell you. In this case, I can't. But more often, I could tell you the actor than I could tell you his character's name.
Yeah.
Right. Like.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's only one name to remember in that context. You know.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So how about? Yellow category, which is killers. In Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, where did Henry and Otis meet?
I have no idea.
I would have gotten this one just because I watched that movie when I was like 10, and it fucked me up.
I've actually like, seen it. This is another one I've never seen, so.
Yeah, like I put that probably in the same category as you know, Last House on the Left. It's a hard one to get through. But you know, one of those iconic ones, and used to show up on HBO like right. their midnight series all the time.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of scenes in Henry's Portrait of a Serial Killer that like I don't even know if like Netflix would run. You know, like now, but HBO was like, fuck it, nobody's up at midnight, we can show whatever. So, here's a snuff film that somebody said, yeah.
So, we were doing back when horror roulette was still a thing. So, like, horror roulette for the listeners, Horror Roulette was this thing that the Screen and Armor used to do, where once a month we would go and they would have like a theme for the month. There'd be four or five movies that fit that theme on this wheel, and we'd spin the wheel and whichever one came up, that's what we'd watch that night. Right. So for Horror Roulette one month, we got, I don't remember, the theme was probably Slashers or something. Right. But we got Maniac, the Joe Spinell one, which is a very good movie. But like I imagine Henry Porter, because Serial Killer is not a fun movie at all. And it is not a movie that is any fun to watch at Horror Roulette. Like, it was a downer movie for everyone there. It was just like, oh, ah.
Killed the move.
Everyone who had been very buoyant and excited was very depressed by the end of the film.
They're all like, yeah. Yeah, I would imagine there are in that type of environment suits itself well to a campy, silly, right. You know, crazy movie.
The movie we're going to talk about tonight would be great there, for example.
Perfect. Yeah.
But,
would be perfect.
Maniac was a downer, it turned out.
Well, you live and learn, unlike many of the people in Maniac or Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. So, hey. Okay, last category. And I think you, you got the first three, you missed the last two, so this is it. You get this one, you're over 50%.
There we go.
We can say you're the genius then. All right, green category is international. What is the nickname? Oh, you're fucked. What is the nickname of the hacker assisting the police investigation in the 2001 movie Suicide Club?
Okay, I know we've done this one, but I also don't remember the name. We've done this one, 100%.
Okay.
But I don't remember, so I still don't know.
So the second way through this card, you did 3 out of 6.
I still failed it. Yep, no, I'm bad.
No. His name was The Bat.
The Bat. You'd think I'd remember that, right? It's a Vincent Price movie. What the hell?
You just need to tell yourself. When I go through this a third time next week.
Right, the hacker in the Suicide Club is a Vincent Price movie.
Right, you'd be like, yeah. The Tingler. Oh, fuck.
Oh no, oh, that'd be a good hacker name. I feel like.
Yeah. Right? I feel like he would just hack porn sites, though.
Right. You know? Yeah. Like, 100%. He's the person who did the Ashley Madison hack.
Oh yeah, perfect. That would be perfect. Also, I would love to be the guy at USA Today that got to write that article. You know, we would have so much fun. All right, man. I think we're ready. I think the time has come. We're super stoked to be talking tonight about the 1988 version of The Blob, and we will start with our essential question tonight, which is: which does the 1988 version of The Blob hate more, the military or religion? Let's take a look at the trailer.
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a body, you could shoot it. If it had a heart, you could kill it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
You were there. You saw.
Plasmid life form that hunts its prey. Predator.
I want that organism alive.
I think you ticked it off.
Terror has no shape.
Holy shit, that trailer is so great. The trailer is so great. Yeah. I love it. It's the perfect voiceover, right? Like, you know, you can't shoot it. It doesn't have a form. And you're like, I don't know what that is, but sign me up. I want to watch that thing.
Yeah. I was actually shocked that, like, it never showed the blob to speak of. Like,
yeah, just like when it's still in, like, the little asteroid thing, you know?
Right. Like, there are so many practical effects in this movie. Like, if this movie was released today, that trailer would be 90% shots of the blob.
Yeah, that's very true. And of which, like, shots of the blob, and it would all be CGI, you know? So, right. yeah, it is what it is. Before we get there, though, before we kind of dive deep, I envisioned this episode especially to break up into kind of two parts. We're going to talk about some of the actors, directors, writers, special effects that are involved, and then we'll kind of finish the episode up by talking about some of the themes. Because as silly and as fun as this movie is, like, it's got some real shit to say, and I was stoked to find that in the rewatch, because it really had been, I don't know, probably since like 1988 or 1989 since I've seen it. So
it had been a long time. It had not been that long for me, but it had been a long time. So
yeah. So Internet Movie Database gives us the brief plot summary here. A deadly entity from space crashes near a small town and starts to consume anyone in its path. Panic ensues as shady government scientists try to contain the horrific creature. And yeah, so I probably one of the important things that we need to talk about are the writer / director here in all of it. Yeah?
Right, yeah.
So, Chuck Russell is, at least the Internet Movie Database credits him with being the director, but I think probably the more interesting stuff comes from the writers, yeah?
Right. And well, Frank Darabont is one of the writers. Yeah. Like, he's, you know, the Frank Darabont of, you know, Walking Dead and The Mist and The Green Mile and Shawshank Redemption and all those. So, you know, it's a good pedigree in that regard.
Well, in like, he's often referred to as like the King Whisperer, you know, whatever. Right. And I think there is a lot of early Stephen King, especially in this movie, like a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, like, so I think the reason that Darabont and King, like Darabont adapting King, worked well is that they both obviously have a real love for like the same kind of pulp horror stuff, like the early 50s movies and comic books is definitely there in both of their work, like Frank Darabont's movies, but also his like actual short fiction, which he's written a little bit of. It's very much like old EC horror comics stuff.
Yeah, right, right, yeah.
And, you know, there's definitely a lot of that in The Blob, like both in its just kind of, you know, it's a 50s monster movie. I mean, it literally is a remake of a 50s monster movie, but also like in that it's very critical of authority, obviously, like we just discussed, but also very like indiscriminately brutal. So like the best thing about it is that it kills people at nearly a random like intervals. Like it's not, it introduces us to main characters, then kills them off camera.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is some of Darabont's, I don't know, dare I say, like techniques that he uses. We see that a lot in Walking Dead, but we also saw it in Shawshank and, you know, everything else that he's done. He really enjoys creating sympathy for characters that he's going to kill off later, right? And that has the simultaneous effect of creating a number of unreliable narrators, but also completely keeping us off balance. We don't know where this film is going to go. I mean, hell, in this one, we kill off a kid like with 5, 10, 15 minutes to go, not very long, you know?
Yeah.
And it's pretty fucking brutal.
I mean, all the kills, pretty much every kill in this is gruesome as fuck. Like, yeah. the effects in this are, I mean, they're really good practical effects. Obviously, they're very ambitious and very big and elaborate, but they're also just incredibly gruesome. Like, everyone melting is horrible melting.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no one dies in a way that is at all pleasant.
Yeah, well, and I, you know, when you read a lot of the criticism of this film, and that was kind of my favorite part of preparation for this episode. Sometimes you read criticism, it can be a little dry because the movie's a little dry, a little academic because the movie lends itself to that. One of my first comments to you as we were prepping for this episode was like, there is just not a ton of academic research specifically about this movie. Now, please, if I'm wrong, direct me to it because I would love to give it a shout out. But like, I spent one whole day looking for an academic journal or something I could really sink my teeth into, but it's not there. That is not to say that there isn't a ton that's been written on it. In fact, there is a lot. It just tends to be more from the pop culture angle, which I think is really cool and interesting and offers kind of a unique perspective to what we're doing. But one of the things that is mentioned a lot in these articles, of which I'll put in the show notes, is the telephone booth scene where, like, one of our main characters finds herself in this phone booth, and suddenly the blob kind of, like, comes in over the top and underneath, and, like, eventually, like, you get her perspective where she's, like, in a fishbowl, essentially, right? And we see all of the other people that the blob is eaten, and they're all like fucked up and just like skulls and, you know, whatever else. Mm-hmm. And it's such a really clever, really interesting way to give us a new perspective on the blob, literally from inside of the blob, which I think is, right. I don't know, so innovative and so cool.
And that's the scene where we learn that one of the characters who was a main character up to that point is dead.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
we don't see him die. Like, we don't see he's got an arc with her, even. Like, he's got an arc. He's one of the main characters. He's had a bunch more speaking lines than almost anyone else in the movie, except our two actual leads.
Right.
And he dies off screen. We don't learn he's dead until we see him in that blob scene.
Yeah.
it's just so indiscriminate feeling at that point. Like, eventually it sort of settles down and you have your two leads. But at first it's just like, nope, we're just going to off random people.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. Well, and I think really that scene goes and gives credit to the special effects designer. And there's a great Birth Movies Death article that kind of discusses, like, I didn't write the name down here in the show notes, but he was like 23 and was in charge of like 37 different major effects, and
right.
To do all of that, like, and it was his idea to make the blob melty, right? To do all of that kind of stuff. And he's like, to make that happen though, he needed a scene like the telephone booth scene where we can see that, like, all of the stuff that could be melty gets melted, but all of, like, the teeth and the bones and that kind of stuff, like, the blob in his mind would just like fucking spit out, you know, like a python after, you know, it's done eating something, which I think is so clever and so interesting and gives rise to these, I just think, really creative and clever, you know, clever special effects.
Yeah. So one of the things that I find really fascinating about, like, looking at this movie versus the 58 version, like I said, I'm going to talk a lot about the differences between the two because I watched them back to back to make sure to do this episode. So, like, the 58 version is obviously way more tame, right, than this version because it's 30 years earlier and the Hays Code is still in effect. But the 58 version we think of, I think, at least I think of, as being very tame, right? I think of it not as being gory at all. And this version is being very gory. But the 58 version does this very subtle thing that is super disturbing and gory, but you don't get to see it. So, like, when the blob first, we think of the blob as being red, right? Because it is in this movie, like, it's red in this movie. It's just this pinkish color. That's the color the blob is, right? In the original, it's not at first. It's clear.
Oh.
And it turns red, and it gets redder and redder as it eats people.
Oh, I like it. Very cool. Very clever.
It's like, no, we can't show it like dissolving people like it does in this one, but we can imply that it did.
Yeah.
By, like, just darkening it throughout the film.
Well, and that goes to, like, the specific look of the blob, right? Like, they have put together this amalgamation of stuff, right? And a couple of these articles that we'll link to will go into the details of it. But the long story short, essentially, it's like rubber cement that is not toxic, that is, you know, but essentially the same chemical makeup, which, not to get on a major tangent, but one of these articles mentions rubber cement specifically as one of the precursors to how they wanted it to look and feel and that kind of stuff. When I was like 10, as a no surprise to anyone that knows me, Halloween's my favorite time of the year, right? My sister came back from college. She's like, we're going to dress up as zombies. And I think I might have been maybe more like 12. I don't know. But I was over trick-or-treating. I wasn't old enough to do it. But she's like, we'll still be fun. We'll hand out candy. We'll pretend to be dead zombies in the front yard and jump up and scare little kids. I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds awesome. And she's like, but I need to put some like oozing sores on your face. I'm like, sign me up. And she did it in rubber cement and then used a blow dryer to like blow dry it so it would dry. Well, I don't know if you've ever read the outside of a rubber cement can, but it says, like, do not place on your skin and do not get close to heat. And we did both of those things. And it for real, like, I was like, it hurts, Tracy. And she was like, suck it up, you know, whatever. You're a zombie. You don't feel pain or whatever kind of, you know, military-esque advice she gave me. So I went like 2 hours with this thing burning the shit out of my face. And I ended up with like an actual blister on my face that came from the chemical burn. So yeah, long story short, your siblings are not makeup artists. Trust the practical effects people to not actually do damage.
To not actually melt you with the blow, right?
Yeah, right, right. Before we get too far removed from it, I also wanted to mention that one of the writers of this film also wrote another one of my absolute favorites, which is Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, Dream Warriors. So, you know, we get, I think, a little bit of that campiness of this film that bleeds into Nightmare on Elm Street too, because that's definitely campy. You know, I'd say it's probably at a peak campy when it comes to Nightmare on Elm Street, but the two leads, right? I knew they looked familiar just by watching it, and then I went and looked at Internet Movie Database. So the lead, right, Brian, is Kevin Dillon, who I knew because I went through this really ill-advised entourage phase in my early 20s. And I'm like, holy shit, that's drama. I'm not proud of the fact that I liked that show. I will hide behind my wife, as I usually do, and say she liked that show too. So we were both in the wrong. But yeah, it's Matt Dillon who's doing Matt Dillon-y things. And then Shawnee Smith, who like immediately, I was like, holy crap. You know, with the new Assam movie that's coming out here in like just a matter of weeks. I was like, oh shit, you know, like this is Jigsaw's protege that we see from an early age and in her teenage years or whatever. But, you know, I think they do a masterful job playing into the camp, but providing the, you know, enough of what they're trying to do to make it compelling. Most important, is a character that nobody talks about. And that's this character here. Let's take a look.
Introducing new Benaka mouthwash. It's so strong, we offer these words of caution regarding its proper use. Grasp the bottle firmly. Open, pour gently. Then, before using, put the bottle down. Repeat, put the bottle down. Now you're ready for the Benaka blast. The Benaka Blast, the blast with taste.
Is he going to take that bottle and just drink the rest of it, which is kind of the impression I get from that?
Thanks, Benaka, for giving us a subtle alcoholic, you know?
Right. Oh, man, that shit was amazing.
Where's Daddy? Oh, you know, he's drinking the mouthwash in the bathroom again. Just leave him alone.
He's passed out on the bathroom floor again with his mouthwash bottle cradled in his arms.
Oh, man, if you're going to be an alcoholic, don't do it with mouthwash. But no, it wasn't the actual mouthwash, but it was the breast spray. Do you remember, like, that was all the rage in late elementary, early middle school, and I completely forgotten it, you know?
I don't think I had that experience.
Oh, man. Maybe it was just specific to my little region here, but, like, yeah, it was really sweet, so it was like a candy, you know? But it was, like, right at that, you know, I started interested in girls, like, in 6th and 7th grade. So you'd go through, like, one of those a day, and, like, it was, I'm sure, terrible for you, but...
You were on your way to becoming a Banaka addict like that guy was. I
mean, yeah, right.
It's a good thing you couldn't get your hands on the bottles.
Yeah, man. Which means we got to move along because I got to go to the bathroom and drink some mouthwash. So,
what's in your cup that you're drinking here? Isn't
it? Yeah, right, right. Leave me alone with my Banaka. Okay, so is there anything else that we want to say maybe about the technical aspects of things? I know you got a ton here both to say about the 1958, but also the 1988. I don't want to step on anything that you want to bring.
Well, I do want to mention before we move on to like themes and stuff, I want to mention that so the 1988, obviously, it came out 30 years exactly after the 58. So back in like... 2009-ish, right? Rob Zombie was attached to maybe direct another remake of The Blob, which sounds bonkers. Like, the concept art and stuff for it just sounds nuts. But he never did it, obviously. But if it had come out in 2018, we could have just kept this cycle going, right? We could have had a Blob every 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. I would totally be down for a Rob Zombie Blob. That'd be interesting. Interesting.
I put a link in the show notes for the concept art, because the concept is really all we have left of whatever it was going to be. But like, it looks real bonkers. Like, there's a monolith. There's this huge stone monolith, and like in one of the concept art, you see like a band playing on a stage in front of this monolith, and it says like the banner above them says like 5th annual Monolith in the Park concert or something. So like, apparently it's been there for like 5 years. I don't know. And there are like blob zombies. There are these people who are like, they're infested with the blob, but they're like zombies wandering around. So they have like their human head and then a blob head. It's bonkers. It looks fucking nuts.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. I gotta check it out. It does. That sounds super bonkers, but I think probably highlights one of the more compelling, parts of this movie, which is all of the body horror that kind of comes into it, you know? Yeah. And there are parts of it that are super uncomfortable, and if you've ever been, I don't know, around a chemical or a foreign substance when it gets on you and like it shouldn't be, you know,
if a sibling ever put cement on your face, for example, right. Yeah,
I would imagine the blob would be like that, only all over your body. So, I think definitely reminded me of, you know, kind of other body horror stuff that we say are kind of icons of the genre, like The Fly and, you know, that kind of stuff. And oh, yeah. I think plays really well in that oeuvre, I think.
Right. I mean, like... the special effects in this definitely rival stuff like The Thing or The Fly.
Oh,
as far
yes.
As just, like... melty goo special effects. They're really ambitious. Like, they're huge. One of the reasons we picked this movie was because of the movie theater scene, right? That's because it's back to the theater week or month. And like, the movie theater scene in the original is, you know, the most iconic scene in the original. And the movie theater scene in this one is almost just as good. And like, when the blob actually gets into theater, it's huge. Like, it fills the whole theater, and it's got big pseudopods coming out and like grabbing people. It's enormous. And so like, it's just such an ambitious, elaborate thing, like, to have built on what I'm assuming is not a huge budget. I mean,
right.
You know, I nothing else about this movie suggests to me that its budget was enormous. And so like, It's just very impressive. And like The Thing, I think, and like you said, the guy was very young when he was doing it. Like The Thing, I feel like this was a person who like just poured everything he had into doing this. Like, really, just really went all the way to try and make this thing come to life.
Yeah, well, and I think I'm glad you mentioned the thing, because it definitely feels like it should be part of a double feature or something, you know, like they definitely feel very similar. But I think both movies really rely on the setting and atmosphere that that setting provides, right? Obviously, mm-hmm. The Thing, you know, uses the outpost in the Arctic to its advantage. And here we get this kind of idyllic 1950s, like, town with a diner and this cute, quaint little movie theater. And I couldn't help but think of a couple of other films that kind of use that same universe, right? One is one of my favorite films of all time, and it's Pleasantville, which uses the artifice as a way, the artifice of this fake small town as a way to tell a larger story. And then The Truman Show, which was actually filmed in like Seaside, Florida, which was a literal town that they created for that movie. And now people live there, which is bonkers to me, you know, like they created this fake town and the people are like, this fake town is pretty cool. You know,
I mean, and it's probably a better use of the stuff than like just destroying it, which is what they usually do when they build things for Hollywood movies. So like,
yeah,
I mean, you know, probably good. Like,
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Definitely better for the environment or whatever.
Right. Just build a town and then let people move into it. What? I mean, what else are you going to do with it?
But I just think that atmosphere gives us more, like, there are so many playgrounds that this movie goes to work in, right? Like the movie theater, obviously. There's the hospital scene, which I just spent the entire time, like, it feels vaguely like a hospital, you know, like I don't know if they got an actual doctor's office to work with or whatever, but mm-hmm. like in this small town, and I'll put a link here. It's actually, I think, a small town in like Kentucky or South Carolina.
I was going to say like Louisiana or somewhere. South.
Oh, I think that's it. Yeah. Yeah. I think it is Louisiana, but like
it's supposed to be Colorado, I think. Right. Or California. It's somewhere they're skiing. Because that's what the economy of the town is built around.
Okay. Because
they're waiting for snow. Right. That's the whole shtick is they're waiting for snow and they have the big snow machines.
Yeah. Right.
That come in at the end. So it's supposed to be a mountain town somewhere there's skiing. I don't remember if it says what state, but it's not supposed to be in the South, but it was somewhere in the South where they actually filmed it.
But the fact that they got to work in this small town in all of these different venues, right? Because you have mm-hmm. the hospital, you have, you know, obviously the movie theater. You also have like the little prison, right? There's at least a little tiny scene there. Like they feel real. They feel, I don't know. They feel almost like vignettes in a haunted house. And I say that lovingly because they are fully formed in right. You know, you don't necessarily see the artifice there, which I think is interesting.
And you go ahead.
I was just going to say, I absolutely love that the receptionist that runs the hospital desk, her first question is, does he have Blue Cross?
Right. But yeah, and it also like mirrors the events of the original movie without feeling too much like it's just retreading it or poking fun at it or trying to deflate it or something. Like it just mirrors it in ways that work.
Yeah.
So all the beats of the original movie are there. So like the scene in the hospital is that same scene is in the original movie. The diner scene is not in the original movie, but it happens off screen in the original movie. Like the blob does go to a diner in the original movie. You just don't see it happen. The scene in the movie theater obviously is there in both cases. And like in the original, it's filmed at least partly in a real town, just like this one is. So like the real movie theater in the original, the Colonial Theater, is where the Blob Fest. So every year they have a blob convention.
Right. Yeah.
And it takes place in the actual Colonial Theater where the original film was shot. And so they reproduce the scene of all the panic people leaving the theater. Like they reenact that every year at Blobfest. And but both movies do that same thing of like tapping into feeling like they're in a real small town, partly by being in a real small town.
Yeah.
The 88 blob definitely, like, it's a dying version, right, of that of that same small town from the 58 version. Just like small towns were dying by 1988, yeah. Like small towns that had been prosperous and would have been able to support a small little doctor hospital thing and a movie theater and whatever in 58 would have been struggling by 88. And just like they would have been, this one is barely hanging on.
Yeah. Well, not so much, I think, with the movie theater, but definitely like the hospital, right, or whatever we want to call that place. It's dingy, and I think it's purposefully done that. So, you know, like, yeah. It's got a doctor and a receptionist, and like essentially that's it. And you know, not to belabor the point too much, but you know, spending a little bit of time talking about the themes, I think it's important to watch that evolution, right? Like, my grandparents grew up in Coffeyville, Kansas, right? And in my mind, it is the quintessential small town, right? Like in the early 80s, they had this really grand theater that I would go and sit in the balcony at. I fucking loved it, you know? It was so great. But by the time like the 90s rolled around, that place was closed, you know? And I think if The Blob 2018 happened, like it would either not take place in a small town or it would consume that small town and nobody fucking know about it, which I think is like even darker, right? Like that's even heavier. Like in my mind, it would be like somebody coming back from the city to visit their grandparents and like just blob shit everywhere, you know? or like Roanoke and like the blobs living right. Under the town. I don't know. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. It is what it is. Yeah. But the kind of the other main theme that I want to spend a little bit of time talking about before we, you know, get to the end of the episode is the idea that the military sucks really bad in this film. And I love that.
So like the military does suck really badly in this film, but like weirdly enough, I think scientists suck even more in this film.
Yeah.
This film
is
super, super prejudiced against scientists. Oh my God. This movie hates scientists.
I always see the scientists as tools of the military, right? Like they exist, right,
but,
you know.
But he's the one running it. As soon as he's dead, that's the true. Military turns on it. The military is like, true. Yeah, fuck it, let's fuck this blob up, right? It's all him.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, and I think
fundamentally that's not so much a distrust of science in this case as it is a distrust of like bureaucracy. Right. It's the people who are detached from reality who are the problem, right? The soldiers who turn the blob, they're just blue collar soldiers. They're not like general, right? They're just grunts. The guys in charge, though, are making these horrible decisions to sacrifice people's lives because they want this organism or whatever. And so I think it's more like it's actually more critical of like just the kind of, I hesitate to use this word because it's become so fraught, but like elites, right? Like people who are making these kinds of decisions without consideration for the lives they're harming. Which, to go back to the dying small town, I mean, those are the people who are killing small towns fundamentally, right? Like there are people who are, there are CEOs or whatever who are making decisions that are pulling businesses and livelihoods out of small towns and sucking them dry, basically. And so, you know, I think there's definitely a big thread of that running through this movie.
Yeah, I like the idea that it's like ambition is what killed the cat. You know, like it is, because maybe it's implied in the film, but like, so they capture this thing, right? And what the fuck are they going to do with it, right? Like study it, do whatever. Like, is the implication that they'll create a weapon, when
they were just doing germ warfare, it was supposed to be a weapon to fight the Russians with, right? Because this was still Cold War, so. But I don't know what they thought they were going to do with it once it was a giant blob. I don't think they meant for it
right.
to do that.
Yeah. Which, you know, to take you to the stinger of the episode, right? I don't know if you can call it a stinger per se, but the very last scene of the film, it's like a religious revival, right? And now we have this priest that is essentially engaged in the same behavior that the military and the scientists were. So it's like, you can't fucking trust anybody.
Nope. So speaking of capturing the blob and what are we going to do with it, since also they never address what the fuck they do with it in this movie, like
yeah.
they freeze it, but it's like 80 degrees. And they're like, we're going to put it in the freezer down at the grocery store. And then what? I don't know. They never specify, but so in the original, they managed to freeze the blob because the blob that's its gimmick. It can be frozen. In the original, they managed to freeze the blob and they airlift it to the Arctic.
Oh, okay.
That's where they put the blob. And the very last line of the original blob is like basically like, you know, the blob zero or whatever. And then one of the other characters says, as long as the Arctic stays cold.
I like it.
Like, well, 60 years later or whatever, right? Like, we're facing global warming. It feels so much more precognizant than it probably was meant to be in 1958.
Yeah, it's so good though. So good. Well, and
I actually want, like, instead of a remake of the blob, I just want a sequel where now, you know, 60 years later, the blob thaws in Antarctica or whatever, right? Because of global warming.
I have not seen the original, so I didn't know any of that. But we made the connection between this movie and The Thing earlier.
Right.
Like, man, what kind of universe do you think the blob stays frozen there for a little while, but then, like, I don't know, becomes The Thing and now takes on a Norwegian mining crew and then some Americans or who knows? You know, like,
right.
I love it. I love it. That's some very seriously cool shit.
So you've never seen the original? Oh, it's so good. You should watch it. So like the single most damning condemnation of the 88 version, the one unforgivable sin of the 88 version is that it contains no version of the original movie's theme song, which is the best theme song ever. It's so good. If you've never heard it, have you heard it at least?
I think you sent it to me on Slack.
I probably did. It's so good.
It is. So, it is.
All listeners, go find, we'll put it in the show notes, go find a version of the original theme song. It's super good.
Yeah, it's so happy and kind of upbeat. And yeah.
Right. The 88 version should have had like a rap version of it or something. It would have been so good.
Oh, now, yeah, sung by the Ninja Turtles. It would have been fucking perfect. It would have been great.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, so we'll cover the last two bits here pretty quick. We'll move now to four films. This is where Oren gives you two, and I give you two films that we think are pretty similar in theme and style. So if you liked this movie, check those out. Oren, you go first.
I picked Killer Clowns from Outer Space and Night of the Creeps, which are both basically this movie with different monsters.
Yeah, I think Killer Clowns especially has some really fun, like, gimmicky shit to it that is a hoot. But yeah, I think Night of the Creeps is...
They're both, like, very much like 50s, you know, aliens land in the woods outside town movies, but updated to very 80s sensibilities. So,
yeah. I think that's definitely fair. Well, I wanted Killer Clowns, but I got to the script late. So my two picks are Creepshow, specifically The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill, which is it's based off a Stephen King short story. Stephen King very famously plays the lead in it. Probably not even my favorite vignette from that, but with the moss covered face and everything else, horror of that.
Well, the whole scene with the meteor is like lifted straight from the blob. So it's identical to the blob scene. So.
And then my second is Critters, both kind of a foreign alien thing. Both, I think, lean into the camp and, they both use the shit out of some really fun practical effects. So it has been a long time since I've revisited Critters, but it kind of made me want to go get into that and like Leprechaun and some of these other things that at least in my adolescence were so popular. And so I don't know.
So Critters is good fun, and it is one of the rare horror movies set in Kansas. So
yeah, exactly. I remember when they make reference to whatever town that they're in, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, theoretically that could happen to me.
Yeah, it's pretty much Critters and Near Dark. And that's about what you get when it comes to movies, horror movie set in Kansas.
It's also made me really fearful of porcupines, because I think that they... I don't, like,
can they shoot their quills like that?
Yeah, right. And they contain poison or whatever. Yeah, dude. Like, to this day, if I were to see a porcupine like walking down the street, A, that'd be weird. But B, I would drive the other way. I'd be like, nope. I'm not fucking with that thing today. Yeah. All right. So our last section today is our anonymous letterbox user who left a below 1-star review of this, our favorite film. And this got a half a star, and it made me chuckle, but they only quoted this line from the movie, which is, "I'll tell you how that meteor is man-made. It's some kind of germ warfare test. They just fucked up." And that's Mr. Dylan's little shtick at the end, and I think really captures the camp and the fun of the film, because I don't think anybody ever admits to that. In fact, it's kind of a throwaway line that, you know, he's like, this is really what happened. And everybody's like, shut the fuck up. And then, you know, the blob gets blown into a billion frozen pieces. So yeah, it is.
Which that's totally how blowing things up works. Absolutely.
Yeah.
They definitely get blown into frozen pieces. That's 100% what happens.
But it made me, have you ever done that with like taffy?
Mm-hmm.
You can freeze it and then hit it, and it's like, I'm like, it probably would. It would taste good to eat some blob. I think it might taste good.
Oh yeah, you'd get like troll gut, but yeah. So I'm gonna derail us for a little bit, even though we're out of time already, because I have to tell the story, because this is the time to tell the story. So I used to work at an ice cream place. So when I was in high school, I worked at an ice cream and burger joint, Brahms, if you've heard of it, if you're from the South. This particular strip of the South, from the South part of Kansas down through Texas. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I used to work at Brahms, and we had at one point these Sundays that were like worms and dirt Sundays or some whatever. Right. And so they had gummy worms with them. Well, they weren't terribly popular. So after a while, when they got discontinued, we had a ton of gummy worms that we'd had for a really long time. Well, as with taffy and things, you could take the gummy worms because they got hard over time. You could take them, you could stretch them. If you stretch them really slowly and carefully, you could stretch them out and you could tap them and they'd shatter like the blob does, right? Okay, well, we were doing this. We took a bunch of these worms home. We were fucking around doing this in a parking lot one time, or in someone's driveway one time. We were stretching these worms and shattering them. And we just left the pieces out there inside. Well, that night it rained. When we came out the next day, the pieces of gummy worm were, I kid you not, like this big. There were these giant blob-looking chunks of gummy worm, right? Because they absorbed all the moisture and just gotten huge.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, and you were like, okay, if I ever become a makeup designer or a special effects designer, I'll know to use this. Yeah,
stale, wet gummy worms.
I forgot to mention this, but this is my favorite part of all the research I did, okay? The alternate title for this movie, or one of the alternate titles, was "The Glob That Girdled the Globe."
That's some good alliteration.
That's so good. I'm just impressed. So yeah, I'll link to the wonderful article that told me that too. So yeah. Anything else to say about gummy worms? About the blob? About Matt Dillon's brother? I don't. You tell me.
No, I think we're good.
All right. Well, where can they find more of your stuff on the internet, Oren?
I am, as always, Oren Gray on every damn thing, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, all that jazz, as well as at OrenGray.com.
Very good. You can find more of my stuff at Ty Unsel, tweeting about the politics of horror, how horrific our politics are, or, you know, I don't know, some teacher stuff, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, Twitter's a fucking hellscape. But that's where I spend most of my time. Or on TikTok. And I, you know, I don't do anything for that. I just watch it. Or you can check out signalhorizon.com, that we will have all of your updated, hopefully smart takes on the horror world. Sometimes smart, sometimes stupid, but hopefully always entertaining. So check me out there. Otherwise, I'll be back here every other week. So what do we have next week for us, Oren?
Next week, I believe we're doing V or Vi. I don't actually know how you say it.
I like it. Yeah. again, that's another one that has been in my, you know, my list of things I need to check out, because it's like, I don't know, really important horror movie. Yeah, but I haven't yet. So I have this great excuse.
Oh my God. It's super good. Yeah. It's, but so yeah, so if you haven't heard of it, if you the listener haven't heard of it, it's 67. I just looked it up because I knew it was 60s, but I didn't remember which 60 year. It's 67 Russian film. It's amazing. And I believe it's on Shudder. So if you have Shudder, I think you can watch it.
Even better. Something that I can, because I ended up having to buy this Blob 1988 version because I couldn't find it streaming anywhere. And I was like, screw it. So yeah.
Well, if you'd been more on the ball, I could have loaned you my copy.
Man, it's all good. Now I got a copy of it and I can rewatch it whenever I want. So
there you go.
All right. Very good. Well, until we meet next time to talk about Vi, be careful of your plastic or rubber cement, and be safe out there. Class dismissed.